If you're struggling in your career, business, or life, this podcast is for you. 9/11 survivor Ari Schoenbrunn shares inspiring interviews so you too can rise like a phoenix from the ashes to live your best life. Here's your host, Ari.
Yep.
Okay, here we go. Welcome to Whispers and Bricks. My name is Ari Schoenbrunn. I'm your host. I have an interesting fellow as my guest today. His name is Joseph Gristel, and he's the founder and CEO of Get Some Class, a company that builds the coolest virtual social fun for businesses. Joseph went from barely eking out a high school diploma to graduating Harvard Law School magna cum laude. Wow. After graduation, Joseph went to work at Davis Polk, one of the best law firms in the country, only to realize that he hated practicing law and was living his life from insecurity and fear. Now, Joseph took advantage of remote work to launch Get Some Class on the side, and after some promising early success, left his legal career to grow the business full time. Joseph also has a side project organizing other Harvard lawyers who no longer practice law and helping other lawyers transition careers. Please help me welcome Joseph Gristel. Joseph, how are you?
Good. How are you? Thank you so much.
Oh, I'm great. Thank you. Well, I got to tell you, certainly seems like, you know, you're quite an accomplished individual. Harvard Law, really impressive. Davis Polk, totally amazing. And, you know, as you know, the name of this podcast is Whispers and Bricks. Now, the whispers are those voices telling you what the right thing to do is, and they represent the good in life. The bricks represent the bad things we go through in life. And God knows we all get hit with bricks throughout our lives at some point in time or another. Now, the reason I asked you to be on the show is because after I read your story, I knew that there were people in my audience who were going through some of the same things that you had gone through. They've been hit with bricks, much like you had, and they needed to hear and to know that they could get through the trials and tribulations the same way that you did. They needed to know that there were whispers out there that could help them. Now, let's start with, it appears that the first brick that you got hit with was in high school, eking out a high school diploma. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. I love the whispers and bricks paradigm. It's a very, very poetic and very beautiful. I went to very, you know, traditional, I would say conservative schools that had a very strong emphasis on religion, which could be great, but actually very much de-emphasized secular education. We had in high school, for example, we had 2 hours of secular study from 5 to 7. And I can tell you those were not much more than time to blow off steam and chase down the principal complaining about some romance scene in some book and why we shouldn't be reading it and stuff like that. So, but I was a curious guy, and, you know, science and reading and these kind of things were always interesting to me. But like, we didn't have any physics or biology or chemistry or even calculus, any kinds of anything sophisticated like that. And to me, you know, that's a large part of the beauty of the world, or at least has become as I've developed. But, you know, at that age, I didn't really realize that yet because, you know, I was just following what people were telling me. And, you know, I completed high school. I didn't have a high school diploma because they didn't do enough coursework to actually get a diploma. And then I spent, you know, a number of years studying Torah in yeshiva in Israel and New York. And then at some point I was like, hey, you know, I don't really think it's my voice that wants to be doing this full time. I'd like to go get to college and get a degree. And to put this in context, I don't think anybody in my high school has gone to college, period. And, you know, I'm 35 now. I think that holds, meaning from my class, meaning there are other people who kind of made their way. You know, I did a bit of extra coursework. I managed to get myself a diploma, and then I took the SAT in Israel at, I think I was 21 or 22. I studied for it on my own. There were two places in Israel that gave the SAT. One was around the corner from my apartment, just by serendipity. And I took it. I managed, I had read a lot. My mother had always encouraged us to read a lot. So I managed to score perfect on the verbal. I did okay on the math. And then I started taking courses at night in Touro College. They had a branch in Israel and Jerusalem. And I started, you know, going in at night, biking over there and taking some initial courses. I did some English writing and some psych courses. I moved back to the States, and over the next few years, I finished my degree. I majored in psychology. I minored in finance. I did some work on behavioral finance just to connect the two. And then I figured, you know, I'll go try to apply to psych PhDs. Now,
Hold on. Yeah. Slow down a minute.
Go ahead.
So you're going from, I didn't take enough courses in high school to get a diploma.
Yeah.
To, I'm going for a PhD.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What a leap that is. Now let me ask you something else. I mean, that's absolutely amazing. You mentioned that you were in Israel. Mm-hmm. How long were you in Israel actually? I mean, you must have left how long?
2 years.
2 years. So you were probably about 18 when you went?
No, I was like 2021.
2021.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. A little bit of a like, what did you do? I mean, high school, you normally end by about 18 years old.
Yes, yeah? I was in a yeshiva in Queens for another 4 years to Israel.
Ah, okay. All right. See, that was the missing piece that I was missing. Okay, so you went to Israel, realized that you're going to need to get some sort of an education if you want to do anything in this world. I mean, yes, it's important to study Talmud and everything like that, but at the end of the day, you're going to need to make a living and you know, you're going to need some sort of an education. I get
it. Yeah, and there was curiosity there. You know, I think the world is unbelievably complicated and has so much beauty. And to me, that's, you know, an integrated spirituality finds ways to find the beauty and meaning in all parts of the world. And that was missing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you go to college, you go to Touro in Israel, and then you come back and you take some more courses, you finish it. You got a bachelor's, I assume?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay, did you, after the bachelor's, did you do any more, did you go on for like a master's or anything like that?
Yeah, I got a master's in Jewish history while I was in the process of applying to psych PhD programs.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's interesting. Okay, so now you got a master's, you got a bachelor's, you got a master's, still nothing that's really going to help you make a living as far as I'm concerned. You know, it's like people who graduate with a degree in English, you know, and it's like, now what? And go,
You can be an English teacher.
You could be an English teacher, yes. Okay, so you got your master's. What was next? What happened?
Yeah, so I had this interest, and I still do have an interest in human psychology and well-being and rationality. And I thought I'd go try to get into an academic program for social psychology, which, you know, it's not like clinical psychology that looks at, you know, abnormal psychology or people's problems. It's focused much more on you know, individuals in society, their well-being, you know, how people conform to society, how people individuate, you know, much more kind of normal psychology in a certain sense. But these programs tend to be rather small, and it's much more of a mentorship model. So professors take on, you know, one student per year, and they're very invested in that student. And so it's much more relational in the sense of this professor has a colleague who recommends this particular student. And, you know, they're more likely to get in because they're investing very much in a particular relationship. And I didn't really have any kind of serious credentials at the time. I probably didn't know what I was doing or how to get in and how to work, how to network. So I didn't get in. You know, I'm happy about that, because even if you're interested in something, when you have to turn it into a career and make money off it, sometimes there are some times where that's the right thing to do, and sometimes where it's just not the right thing to do, and mm-hmm. needing to force your curiosity into something financial is not the way to go. And then I was kind of like, yeah, what do I do now? And I had a kid already, and I needed to start earning money, and I didn't know.
Oh, so you were married at this point?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, how old were you when you got married, if you don't mind my asking?
I was 24.
24.
Yeah.
Okay. Kind of middle of the road in the Orthodox, in the Jewish Orthodox world, I think.
Yeah, right.
Not too old, not too young.
Yeah, it was relatively young, contextually. You know, you're still not so developed at that age, but socially, it was in the norm.
Okay, so tell us what was with Harvard Law?
Yeah, so I mean, law school was kind of just a path that led to a solid job. With law school, it's more, the numbers are much more in your favor. So if you're bright and you can get, you take tests well, you can get strong test scores, getting into a solid law school is not as challenging as getting into a small, you know, academic PhD program. Harvard is challenging to get into, but they do accept like 800 or so students into their class per year. So there are maybe 6,000 applicants or more. But at the same time, if you're bright, they're not necessarily looking, it's not that kind of relational, then you don't need to have a relationship with a particular individual. As long as you score well on your LSAT, you know, and you have a reasonable resume, you have a good shot at getting in. So I took the LSAT. I took a course. We did a diagnostic in the beginning, and I scored on my diagnostic 172. I think the highest you can get is 180. And I took it to the guy leading the course, and he's like, you know, if you want to back out, I'll give you your money back. I think I'll get you up, you know, as high as you can go. But if you want to back out, I'll give you your money back. But I figured, you know, it's worth taking it. And it was. This guy was awesome. Fischl Benzinger, LSAT by Fish. He's very well known. Awesome. Really awesome teacher. And I took the LSAT. I applied. I got in. I applied to, I think, 5 or 6 schools. And I think I got into all of them except for Yale. Yale doesn't know how to distinguish the goods, obviously. No. Hey, they're very
selective.
What's
his name go? Didn't George Bush go to Yale?
Yes. Not Yale Law School, though. I don't think he's a lawyer. But they have a much smaller class and they're looking for pedigree and things like that. So yeah. Anyway. I got in and, it was a little bit of deciding, but when you get into Harvard, you take it seriously. Obviously my wife was hesitant to move off to Boston, a bit random, but we ended up moving there and it was a very, very positive experience for both of us. Cause there was a whole group of us that lived together in Brighton, which is a neighborhood in Boston. We had a lot of close friendships that evolved over time, which was really, really beautiful. And law school itself was just an awesome, awesome experience being in Harvard and being able to avail myself of the intellectual riches in a place like that.
Wow. That must be amazing. You know, you're talking to a guy who, you know, went to Bar-Ilan University, you know, in Israel. It's, you know, Harvard Law. I mean, you know, I'm in awe. I have to be honest with you. So you graduated, I assume.
Yeah.
Harvard Law.
Yeah. And, well, why don't we spend a moment just on the school for a second?
I'd love to. Hey.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's really, you know, coming from an all boys schooling straight through for like 25 years, walking into a university that was co-ed and that had so many bright, intelligent people. It's just a really, really powerful experience. And you're talking about a place where like, every week there's someone coming in there who's just like, and giving a talk or a small session, and they're just unbelievable. So, you know, justices on the Supreme Court would come, a few of them would come each year, congressmen, senators, heads of agencies. I actually took a class with 20 students. I think it was a January term class with Brett Kavanaugh before he became a Supreme Court justice.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
So that was,
so cool.
Awesome. It was just awesome opportunity. And I just have to say this, once we're on that subject, he's an awesome guy. And it was just, I felt so bad by what happened to him and how he was dragged through the mud. I'm not going to comment on history or that, you know, but I can tell you character wise from what I saw and interacted with him, he was such a good person. He listened so carefully, considered opinions. He was thought out. He was humble. It was just real, really wonderful experience. And I think he totally deserves to be on the bench and is really, really, good person to have as justice.
Well, thank you for that. I'll have to send him an email, let him know that that you think very highly of him.
Yeah, we actually signed a letter. You know, a bunch of his students got together during the nomination process, and I think 80 of us or some signed a letter, you know, attesting to our experiences with his character.
That's great. That's great. Wow. Okay, so you got through Harvard.
Yeah,
amazing.
I did.
Now, what have then you have to what? They have to take the bar, right?
You got to take the bar. Yeah.
Yeah. How is that? How is that for you?
The bar was okay. You know, you got to put in your time studying. Basically, everyone takes one of these curated courses with Barbary or Themis or some other bar prep company. And the law firm that you're going to usually foots the bill. You spend, 2 months studying and then you go take it. I took it. I left an hour early. I did just fine.
Passed it on the first shot.
Passed it on the first shot. Yeah. Like, I think I was in like the top 5 or 10% or so. But
gee, I wonder why I'm not shocked.
Yeah. test taking is thankfully not been a challenge for me. So I took the bar, went to work at Davis Polk, which is an awesome law firm. They do, their work is excellent. The people there are so competent, so many really bright people, right. A lot of nice people there as well. And it was just an awesome learning experience in terms of the just getting a sense of excellence, reliability, quality of work, and the like. At the same time, it was an awesome learning experience because I realized there's no way that I was going to enjoy or be able to practice law as my primary occupation long term, especially in kind of a large law firm where I'm just, a small part of a huge picture.
Really? Wow. So how long were you with Davis Polk?
I was there for 3.5 years.
3.5 years. Yeah. Okay.
But, I really realized early on in the game that it's not going to be my, I'm not going to survive there. The pay is unbelievable in these places. This year I'd be earning $400,000 and the partners this year on average were earning $6.5 million, just to give you a sense of what's on the table. But like, you have to be doing that basically your whole life. And it's like a very, very demanding career, so they're working nonstop. They're always on call. And, the way I saw it is the money's not worth anything if I don't have the ultimate currency in my life, which is how I get to use my time. And so right. It doesn't really matter to me how much money I have if I don't control my time.
Right. Sounds like it's not unlike, guys that go into work on Wall Street, investment bankers and like everybody wants to be. I remember, I spent 30 plus years on Wall Street. And I've seen kids come and go. And every time you talk to them, it's like, why do you want to be an investment banker? And it's like, because the money is so great. I said, but, have you considered quality of life or anything like that? All they saw were dollar signs.
Yeah.
Right. And so I imagine that you had certainly in the top tier law firms, probably the same type of attitudes as well. Well, the money is great. Yeah. But, you have to. What about your quality of life?
Yeah.
And yeah. So I hear you. So at what point, what was the final, call it the final straw that broke the camel's back, the brick that you got hit with that ultimately led you to actually leaving law and becoming an entrepreneur?
Yeah. Well, I think the brick, kind of is the whole experience. And I was looking relatively early on for something that would be more compelling and would talk to talk to my strengths and autonomy and give me more autonomy and control over my life. And, but I was stuck because, I needed income. I couldn't jump into nothing. And that wouldn't be responsible. And I didn't really know where to go. I also hadn't had much time in my life for just self-exploration and trying different things. So, I was in yeshiva for many years and I was in college and then I went to law school and then I'm practicing as a lawyer. And that's really my first work opportunity. So, where was I going? I considered things like consulting or investment banking, but I just felt the same kind of, miasma of like, considering doing those things because it wasn't my soul that wanted to do those things. It was just, I was, kind of like, this isn't for me. Maybe I should jump to that, but not really going there because that was actually interesting to me. I kept, thinking and reflecting. And at one point I started a project relating to data privacy because a friend had started something, even though that was also, opportunistic, there was nothing there interesting for me, but I'm like, okay, this is going to be better than than what I'm currently doing. But, you know, that didn't pan out. We decided to let it go. The space was too crowded. And then the pandemic came along. And, you know, I don't know if you watched Game of Thrones. I imagine you didn't. But there's this character there called his name is Littlefinger. And he's always scheming and, you know, finding ways to climb up the ladder. And he has this saying. Chaos is a ladder. And it comes up a few times in the series. At the end, you know, he gets paid back by, he gets held to account with that statement. But it's true, you know, chaos and disruption create a need for people to build new things to respond to the new world. And we're very much in a new world because, you know, our whole work life has been shifted to a whole different way of working. So I was thinking during the pandemic about virtual classes of one sort or another, maybe for kids to keep them occupied while they're at home. And then I participated in some, you know, social events on Zoom at work, corporate social events. And I thought, you know, what about virtual corporate events? So I reached out to the events director of my firm and I said, hey, you know, can you help me understand the space? I don't want to remain as a lawyer long term. I want a sense of, you know, how this works. And we had a couple of conversations. He was very gracious, very supportive. And at one point I suggested, what about a chess event? Because my brother had gotten me back into playing chess during the pandemic online. And so I just popped it out. And she's like, that sounds interesting. Why don't you put it together and do a demo? So I went ahead. I found like a top US chess champion, you know, one of the best players in the world. Sam Shankland, his name is. He's like number 29 right now. And I reached out to him. I looked for a player that didn't have an agent that was pretty high. And he was the first one I found like that. And I said, hey, would you be up for this? And he's like, sure. So we did a test run with a group of friends. I put together a package to go along with the event, a chess set and a chess themed snack package. I think I've shown it to you with the chessmen cookies and the milk and white chocolate queens.
I remember.
And yeah, so I sent it to them in its kind of early form. And we did it. We had a little tutorial and a strategy talk and then a little tournament on Zoom together. And they liked it. So I was like, okay, if they liked it, then I'm going to go invite other events people at other law firms to come to see a demo. So I invited like a whole bunch of events people at law firms to come. And we did a demo and they liked it. And then a friend who had participated in the test run asked me to do it for his company. We did it. And then 2 weeks later, one of these law firms, White & Case, number 20 in the country or something, asked me to do the event. And we did it for them. And then I figured, you know, I'm going to make some other events. So I made a couple others and I started marketing them. And then I landed a program in March for Oliver Wyman and the Boston Consulting Group, focused on women in chess, where we went through the chess of the Queen's Gambit. It's a super popular Netflix chess-based series that had just come out right after I created the first chess concept.
Timing super, is everything, yes. Isn't it?
Yeah, I didn't know it was coming out. It was a blessing, a real blessing. And so once I landed those programs for the Boston Consulting Group and Oliver Wyman, I said, you know, look, I'm landing clients like this, doing this on the side surreptitiously while I'm doing my law job. I'll find ways to build enough programming and build enough clients over time. I think it's prudent at this point and not completely irresponsible to jump ship and try to build this into a business. So I decided I'm going to go for it. And I left March 1st. I had a custom sand art video made for me to make my departure positive and memorable by a sand artist. And I emailed it to the whole firm with a nice letter, you know, saying all the qualities I'd learned from the firm and that I decided to go on. I said, people say life is not about fun and games, but I never believe what people say. So I'm going into the business of fun and games.
Wow, that's great. So let me ask you this. The name of the company is Get Some Class.
Mm-hmm.
What was, you know, how did, I'm not sure how that relates.
Well, I see what we're doing as providing rich and inspirational instruction. So the first line of products that we did is a line of social events, but even within the social events, there's ideally a learning goal in there. So for example, you know, with the chess program, there's a significant amount of chess instruction going on. And then there's an interactive element as well. We have a painting program, but the painting program is curated around environmental art and with an artist that paints coral reefs, and she talks about coral reefs. Mm-hmm. In addition to leading the painting, well, the painting is, we do a simple coral reef painting, and sometimes I'll bring on a marine biologist as well. So the goal is really not just to have fun, but to do it in a way that's intellectually rich, educational, and inspirational as well. The other thing to note is that the direction, larger direction of the company, I see more in kind of, you know, rich, fun, engaging classes rather than just social events, if that makes sense. So this kind of element of education is integral to what it is.
So classes in like classroom type of that, as opposed to I'm a classy guy.
Well, that's the double entendre of the name, is the classy. It has a dual meaning. That's kind of the play on words. But yes, classes, right. not as in a classroom, as a classroom often conveys, you know, to people a sense of boredom or of work. And we're trying to do things in a way that it's all fun. But still educational. But that said, you know, we're looking, we have a beta program focused on a concept I call master classes at work. And the idea there is that if you have a company and your team is distributed around the country now and people aren't connecting, you need to worry about how you build community and relationships amongst the individuals in your company, because that's integral to having a sense of shared enterprise that makes a good company. So how do you do that? And this is, in my view, the problem of the decade, given how COVID has upset the workplace. So you need to think about this in many ways, but one, you know, often like one solution or partial solution to it is this concept. And the way it works is basically we offer you a series of really cool classes with world-class experts in different domains. So for example, you know, chess with a US chess champion, art with a world-class artist, how to cook meat with an expert meat chef, improvisational dance with a, you know, a world-class dancer. And people get to take that class together at work with the same group around an interest that they all share with on a recurring basis just for fun. And that's just a means of connection. So that's more in the class direction.
That is incredible. That's what a story. What a great, great story. I'm so happy you've joined me here today. If people want to get a hold of you, all right, whether it's because they're, you know, they're interested in hiring you and your program, or because they, you know, need some advice, they, you know, they hate their job and they want to, you know, they want to talk to somebody who is in that position. So what would be the best way for people to get a hold of you? Do you have a website? Do you have an email? What would be the best way?
Yeah, we're in the 21st century, so we have both of those. It's getsomeclass.com, getsomeclass. And my email is joseph@getsomeclass.com. That's just J-O-S-E-P-H at getsomeclass.com or events@getsomeclass.com for booking purposes. Either one of those will do. And people are more than invited to get in touch for either purpose, whether events or, you know, just chat.
Just chat. Great. That's wonderful. Last but not least, do you have any words of wisdom that you would like to share with my audience?
Yeah. So, I mean, I love the whispers and bricks wrapping. I think it's really nice. There are things I think there are bricks that get thrown into your life. I think Ari, your story is more of kind of some really powerful brick getting like really thrown into your life. Yeah. Right. and then there are bricks that, you know, there are ever present. So they were kind of there in many ways. Maybe it's you've kind of lived your whole life or much of your life in an attempt to be something for someone else or for many other people. And that's kind of an underlying brick that's, you know, itching existentially in the background. And for some people, they live their entire lives without becoming conscious of those bricks. And, you know, I remember I had a close relative, you know, who passed away. But like, her whole life, she thought of herself as just like, you know, like a rag. Just, and she would say the most horrible things in regard to how she thought about herself. Yeah. And that's, you know, it's all this kind of story that she internalized from her surroundings. And it's just what a shame it is to live your life like that. But that I bring that up just as an illustration of how you can live with a brick that's there that you never ever realize. You know, the other side, the bricks are the whispers. The whispers are, you know, there's a wise part of yourself that whispers and wants to guide you in a direction that can allow you the kind of fruition and self actualization that is your birthright. But it's a, you know, skill to be able to kind of learn to listen to that, to those whispers, and, you know, have a dialectic, a give and take with those whispers that allows you to learn about yourself and what it is, where it is you're going. I like to say that, you know, a career or a job is a data point. It's not your destiny. And the fact that you went to school for something or you started in a particular job, you use that as data to inform what you should do next, but not as something that says, oh, you spent all those years doing this. Like, how are you going to leave that? Like, yeah, we need most, some people are born knowing what they want to do, but many other people, it's a process of self-exploration. If you don't try your hands at something, it's hard to know. And then you kind of want to approximate over to things that match your skill set and, you know, are self-actualizing for you in more, in better and better ways as you try new things.
Yeah. It's interesting because I interviewed a woman who, you know, went to high school, went to college, went to medical school, spent 4 years in residency, did 10 years as an attending, and then quit.
Yeah.
Because wow. She was just totally burnt out. All that wow. schooling, all that work. She quit. She became a coach. Wow. And she coaches people in the medical field who are suffering from burnout.
Wow.
And she helps them get through it. It's absolutely amazing. Wow. So it's kind of along the same lines.
Yeah. Joseph, well, she was much more invested than I was, but that's brave.
Yeah, absolutely. Joseph, thanks so much for sharing your story with my audience. I'm sure you've touched the hearts of many people in my audience. Good luck going forward. You've been listening to Whispers and Bricks, and I'm your host, Ari Shoman. Until next time, listen to the whispers, avoid the bricks, and never, ever give up on your dreams. Bye for now.
So that's it for today's episode of Whispers and Bricks. Head on over to iTunes and subscribe to the show. One lucky listener every single week that posts a review on iTunes will win a chance in the grand prize drawing to win a $25,000 private VIP day with Ari himself. Be sure to head on over to whispersandbrickspodcast.com and pick up a free copy of Ari's gift and join us on the next episode.